Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I am joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm aces.
I'm happy to be talking about the Batman with friends.
First up, in controversies and non-controversies, going to see The Batman in theaters will cost you a little more, at least if you go to see it at an AMC. The movie theater company rolled out an experiment in variable pricing this weekend, charging moviegoers a dollar more to see The Batman than other movies at the same time. Charging more when a new blockbuster drops is a time-honored Hollywood tradition. I remember being shocked. Shocked, I tell you, at the age of 16 when it cost 50 cents more to see a movie at my local theater in Stafford, Virginia, when Star Wars The Phantom Menace dropped in theaters. But it cost 50 cents more to see every movie. All the prices went up at the same time. What AMC is trying here is a little bit different. They're attempting to charge people more just to see The Batman. So if you wanted to see Cyrano at 9:30 on Thursday evening last week, that ticket would have run you a little more than $15 in Dallas at the AMC North Park, my home base. See you there. But if you wanted to see The Batman at the Dallas AMC North Park, it would have cost you a little more than $16. Again, a little more than a dollar more. Needless to say, people on the internet were outraged about this because people on the internet get outraged about everything. They accused AMC CEO Adam Aaron of trying to gouge people, of scaring people away from movies, et cetera, et cetera. But it's actually a good idea? Question mark? Or at least the beginning of a good idea. Look, here's the thing. Theaters are struggling, and they're struggling in large part because the only movies that are attracting big audiences at the moment are comic book movies. Showings of Spider-Man No Way Home and The Batman are the only things I see regularly selling out on opening weekend. Meanwhile, I haven't set foot in a theater that was more than half full for almost anything else. Maybe. I literally went through every movie I remember going to see, and the only one that might have been more than halfway full, The Green Knight on opening weekend. Everything else had about 20 people in it. I'm talking about like Army of the Dead, Licorice Pizza, Clifford the Big Red Dog, all of these movies, 20 people, that was it. All of which is to say, there's a supply and demand issue at work here. On top of that, though, you have a very simple product difference. The Batman didn't cost as much to make as Dog, and it's offering a different sort of experience from Sing 2. You wouldn't expect an M-Class BMW to cost the same as a Chevy Malibu, now would you? You wouldn't expect a three-hour, $200 million action epic to cost the same as a 90-minute, $80 million family movie, or a $5 million, 140-minute indie, right? On top of that, the theaters already do variable pricing. That's why matinees cost less than evening shows. That's why IMAX and Dolby screens cost more than standard screens. That's why 3D came with a premium charge, even if everyone hated wearing those dumb glasses. Look, the big issue for my POV is that AMC isn't taking the next logical step here and reducing prices for movies that are underperforming or not drawing an audience. There's no reason Cyrano shouldn't be discounted in an effort to get people into theaters. There's no reason Sing 2 should still be at full price when it's available on VOD already. People think it's gouging because they're not seeing any of the lower price benefits, only the costs. Right, Peter?
Yeah, I just think the outrage over this is really misguided. Variable pricing, like you said, has always been part of the theatrical experience. And you actually, you skipped one way that we've had variable pricing in the past, although not so much anymore, which is that we used to have second run movie theaters. And this used to be a way that that people who, in many, like kids who didn't have a lot of cash or college students who just wanted to go see a lot of movies, like me, for example, were able to go see movies two or three months or 4 months after they came out in first-run theaters, and the price would be a half or a third as much as a first-run movie. So when I was in college in Lexington, Kentucky, there was a $2 theater, and that was $2 on Saturday night for an adult ticket. And so that's one of the reasons that I was able to see The Matrix that year in 1999, my freshman year in college, like 4 or 5 times, because I just, it was anytime you didn't have something to do on a Friday or Saturday night, you just drive across town and see The Matrix for $2. And it was great. And the thing was, you could pay $6.50 or $7 to see The Matrix on opening weekend in March or April, whenever it was that it came out earlier in the year, or you could wait. And this has always been part of the way that Hollywood prices movies, is that different experiences, sometimes bounded by time, sometimes bounded by the particular feature set of that theater, sometimes bounded just by, you know, to some extent by interest in a movie, because movies that did better would obviously play in first run theaters for a lot longer, and so would take longer to get to those second run theaters. And so it has always been the case that theaters and studios charge different amounts depending on the experience. And that's still going on here. You know, it's not just at AMC. If you go see The Batman at the Alamo Drafthouse in Washington, D.C. right now, they're playing it in what they call their big screen experience. It is the biggest house in the Alamo Drafthouse, and I believe it's one of the biggest screens, maybe the single biggest non-IMAX screen in the Washington, D.C. area. It's really great, just a great theatrical experience, and it costs a little more for a seat in their big screen theater than it does if you go see it in a small screen. And this just seems to me like a fairly obvious way to price movies that is going to end up being good for fans, I think, in long run, because this is going to be part of how movie theaters stay open and keep themselves viable. We have talked in the past about whether it is possible for movie theaters to survive in a world where people only really go see comic book movies and video game adaptations and IPs that have, you know, big brands already. And one of the ways they're going to do that is they're going to look at, these are the cash cows: Fast and the Furious, Batman, Marvel movies, Uncharted 2, 3, 7, right? Like, I'm so excited for Uncharted 7. That's the one where they're going to reboot it and it's going to be wonderful. Those movies, you have to get more out of them in a world where people aren't going to see the other things. But what that does is when Uncharted 7 when someone is paying $2 more for the Uncharted 7 seat, that means that Cyrano 2, which is going to be awesome, can still get released in theaters or something like that. It means that the theaters will continue to exist. And as always, the people who pay more, right? This is just like first class in airplanes. First class seats don't cost like 15% more, even if you are only taking up 15% more space. They cost like two or three times as much in many cases. But what that does is it reduces the cost down in coach. And so that's the same effect here is going to take place. And so I just see this as being ultimately good for movie theaters and a way to adjust in a trying market, and hopefully good for fans in the long run if you like going to see movies at the theater. And if you don't, stay home, watch it on streaming, and you have that option now too.
Yeah, I mean, Alyssa, this is the big question. This is the big, you know, what everybody's wondering. Does this just encourage people to wait that 45-day window to watch Batman on HBO Max?
Well, one of the things we've talked about a lot on this podcast is the extent to which, by pivoting to streaming so aggressively, studios like Disney have cut themselves off from potential revenue streams. But what it actually ought to do is allow them more flexibility. Take the example of something like Encanto, which became a huge hit because it was streaming on Disney Plus during the Omicron wave. It was it was something that families could watch with their kids over and over again. But it also, you know, had these viral songs like "We Don't Talk About Bruno." I would actually love, but you know, Disney is now not beholden to, you know, a bunch of secondary rights deals that it's made, right? I mean, it's, you know, they don't have to worry about, you know, feeling like they're undercutting a, you know, cable channel to which they've sold this or their video cassette sales. Why not put Encanto back in theaters for a while now? I mean, that's the kind of thing that I would love to have be my oldest kid's first movie theater experience. She already knows that she likes the movie a lot. You know, it would be comfortable for her to go. She wouldn't have to worry about being scared. It would be exciting. It would be fun, you know, but it would also be a little bit different. And so it would be great to see some of these places that have, you know, gotten so aggressively vertically integrated at the expense of secondary revenue streams actually sort of take the opportunity to give the, you know, fans of their existing products a new experience with those products and actually open up another revenue stream for themselves.
I mean, in some ways, you're talking about bringing back a kind of second run.
Exactly. I mean, and I think that, you know, if we saw that sort of flexibility again, you know, I think Sunny is absolutely right that, you know, people aren't seeing the upside of variable pricing or the upside of more creative approaches to programming theaters that should be possible in this environment. And, you know, I think that would be smart business for places that have cut themselves out of an enormous number of revenue streams, but it would also be smart for fans. It would be, I think it would be a lot of benefit for everybody. And look, you know, I can't tell you how many times I've paid the $20 to see a movie in the Dolby Theater at Georgetown, which, you know, it's ridiculous to pay those $20, kind of, but it's a big theater. It's a good theater. You know, the sound is pretty well calibrated. The seats are comfortable. And so, you know, we've all been paying variable prices for years. It's $1, it's $2, you know.
I mean, I do think that, look, I think there is something to be said for the idea that tickets are already very expensive. Making them more expensive is going to, you know, decrease the interest in going. I am sympathetic to the idea that
inflation is a real thing for a lot of Americans, right?
Inflation is a real thing for a lot of Americans. I mean, we could talk about, like, how expensive tickets are now versus how expensive they were 20 years ago, 30 years ago. It's still cheaper to go to a movie than to do all sorts of other things. But I'm sympathetic to the idea that, like, I don't want to pay extra money. This isn't fair. And this is why I think AMC, look, my big problem with this is that AMC has rolled this out in the worst way possible by, like, reinforcing all the ways in which variable pricing makes things harder for the consumer by increasing costs and, you know, et cetera, instead of saying, like, yes, we're going to charge you a dollar more to see The Batman. However, you can go see Dog for $2 cheaper tonight if you'd rather go do that. We want to get people in to see West Side Story before the Oscars. Come watch West Side Story. Come watch Steven Spielberg. Tickets for West Side Story are going to be $5 this week. Something like that. I mean, the other problem, though, is that this creates a real advertising problem. How do you let people know what is cheaper when? How do you keep them apprised of all this? I mean, it is a challenge. It's always a challenge to get people into theaters.
Or think about ways to make that dollar worth something, right? I mean, you know,
By giving them NFTs? By giving them the Batman NFTs?
Or, you know, having an exclusive interview with Matt Reeves that airs after the credits have rolled, or Robert Pattinson, or, you know, some sort of, like, extra content that, you know, maybe extends the time that the theater is tied up by 5 minutes, but makes people feel who care about that feel like they're getting something. Or, you know, cutting a commercial, or, you know, just finding any small way to enhance the theater going experience, which, as we've talked about, in a lot of places is just not that great. And so, you know, trying to tell people that they're getting something for their money that's not that expensive for a theater to provide would be smart as well.
I mean, to some extent, this is just a reflection of the way that prices are the way that we allocate scarce resources and seating to see Batman, the most popular movie in theaters, is actually a scarce resource, at least on the opening weekend and probably through additional weekends. That's what prices do, is they allocate resources based on demand. And there's just more demand to see Batman. In addition, it's a more expensive product. And this is something that filmmakers have been talking about, for at least a decade, maybe longer. I remember back in the aughts, around the time that Avatar came out, James Cameron complaining, you know, he has a history of making very expensive movies. I believe Terminator 2 was the first $100 million production budget film. And he's always pushed the envelope in terms of production budgets. And he was complaining that his movies cost the same to see as the people who are making movies for $5 or $10 or $20 million, and that was a challenge for him. Now, what that meant was that he had to make movies that attracted a lot larger audience, because, of course, you know, he has to make his money back on $100 million, and in some ways that's the trade-off there. But he wanted to see variable pricing just based on budget, and that didn't seem like a crazy thing to me. But it's always been something that exhibitors have resisted, in part because they understand that there is, you know, a reaction to this, in the same way that airline travelers have reacted negatively at times to this sort of what they feel like is the nickel and diming of the experience. But this is how these businesses stay afloat. And what all of these businesses inevitably end up doing is trying to extract the most money from the products that are most in demand and the people who are most willing to spend that money, right? And so, to some extent, this is what you might think of as a premiumization strategy, which is the Batman on opening weekend in particular is a premium product. It is a high demand product that is different than all of the other offerings, especially these days, where all of the non-Batman things in the theater are things that, like, only kind of, like, frankly, only weirdos are going to see non-superhero movies at this point. It's like the three of us and, you know, people who listen to this podcast, but it's not a lot of people who are going to see other things. The demand is not exclusively, but so heavily falls on just a couple of movies at this point that theaters and studios are going to start looking for ways to extract more money from those films, in particular more money on opening weekend, when there legitimately are issues getting seats and sort of, and distributing those things. And so one of the things that the AMC, just one more thing, that the head of AMC, when he was announcing this, said was, we've been doing this in Europe for forever. And not only do we do it based on the movie, but we also do it based on the seat in the theater, because some seats are obviously better. And this is just, this is true. There are scarce resources. And like some of the middle seat, you know, two thirds of the way back is the one that is going to look and sound the best. And the very front row seat where you're craning your neck is the one that's going to be uncomfortable. And some people will charge more, will pay more for the better seat.
Yeah. I mean, that's the kind of thing that would be much easier to do now that movie theaters have effectively permanently, I think, mostly switched to online seat selection, which has been a huge improvement in movie going to come out of the pandemic, right? I mean, never having to show up to a movie theater 20 minutes early again and sit through the just parade of inanity being shoved into your eyeballs in order to get a decent seat is a vast improvement in movie going. So why not do that kind of variable pricing that Peter is describing? But also, why not do the kind of variable pricing where, yeah, Batman costs the Batman costs $1 or $2 more to see opening weekend. But if you are a repeat ticket buyer for it, you get a steep discount, right? I mean, that, you know, if you do that through Fandango or AMC's website or whatever, I mean, there are just ways to do this that confer obvious benefit to consumers, but that also provide an incentive for people to go see the damn thing a second time, right? I mean, you know,
MoviePass is relaunching.
I'm curious how this jibes with AMC's general strategy to try and funnel people toward their A-list program, right? Like the idea that you're going to pay $20 a month for AMC, the right to go see, you know, three movies a week at AMC or whatever. Like, does that undercut that strategy? Is it designed to push people toward it? I mean, do you get a little ding that says, hey, if you sign up for A-list, you get to watch this movie basically for free?
Maybe a little bit. I think ultimately what this does is it creates even more of a divide between people who just wait to watch everything on streaming and people who go to the movies to see something in a theater. Because this movie, The Batman, that we're going to talk about here in just a minute, is going to be available to watch on HBO Max sometime in the middle of April, right? It's like 45 days or something like that. That's the window. And this sort of pricing strategy is basically going to say, if you really care about The Batman, if you really care about seeing a movie theatrically, then we're going to ask you to pay more for that experience. On the other hand, like the flip side of that is that these things will be available to everyone for a relatively modest cost. I mean, no streaming service, even if you were subscribed to all of them, you're paying for the equivalent of two or three movie tickets a month, something like that, right? Maybe four. And so the sort of the flip side here is that people who don't want to go to the movies at all and don't want to pay these premium prices and don't want to worry about this are going to be able to see things 6 weeks later, which is faster than I used to be able to see things at a second run movie house, you know, as recently as 2000.
Yeah. All right. So what do we think? Is it a controversy or a non-controversy that AMC is charging folks more to see The Batman? Peter?
Well, some people think it's controversial, but they shouldn't.
Alyssa.
It's a non-troversy.
Not only is it a non-troversy, it's an active good. A quick programming reminder. Rather than posting both episodes of Across the Movie Aisle on Tuesdays, as we had been doing, we're spreading the love a little bit. Main episode's going up on Tuesday. They will be available simultaneously on Substack and your preferred podcast app, iTunes, Spotify, whatever. The bonus episode will post on Fridays, and it will continue to only be available to members of Bulwark Plus. So go to atma.thebulwark.com. Get signed up if you want that special members-only bonus episode. This week, we are talking about Volodymyr... I'm going to botch this name 17 times in the bonus episode, so just get used to it. Volodymyr Zelensky's experience as an actor and how it is helping him win the PR war in Ukraine's fight against Russia. And now on to the main event, The Batman. The latest reboot of Bruce Wayne's crime-fighting vigilante from director and co-writer Matt Reeves, who is best known for Cloverfield and the latest Planet of the Apes movies. Standard reference points for The Batman include David Fincher's Seven and David Fincher's Zodiac. It's a sprawling, stylish crime epic about a brutal murderer and the social unrest he causes. There's a dash of Taxi Driver and Rorschach from The Watchmen as well in the opening moments during a voiceover in which, you know, Batman is talking about the streets and the crime and all that. An idea that gets echoed a little bit in the closing moments when a real rain shows up to clean the city streets off. Batman is aiding Commissioner Gordon in his efforts to solve a series of high-profile murders by the Riddler. With the help of cat burglar Selina Kyle, he infiltrates the city's underworld, which is personified in this case by the Penguin and Carmine Falcone, only for Bruce to learn that Gotham's corruption can trace its roots all the way back to his own family. Whoa, drama. By way of praise, I will say that the movie looks quite good, though I could have used slightly less focus pulling, maybe. It's okay to just leave images in focus for a while, Matt. I love the score. It's too long, and I'll touch on that a bit more in a second, but I was never bored, which is important. The acting is all pretty great. I liked Robert Pattinson as Bruce Wayne / the Batman as an emo kid. I liked Paul Dano, who's playing the Riddler, like Heath Ledger played the Joker. I like Zoe Kravitz, who's playing Selina Kyle, with about as much sexiness as you can pour into a PG-13 comic book film and get away with it. And Colin Farrell, truly a joy as the Penguin. He's just hamming it up. He's chewing the scenery. For a movie that has been described by some folks as quote-unquote humorless, I found it has a dark, dry humor to it. It's not quippy, but it's certainly not somber or mordant. Here is my beef with the Batman. The final 40 minutes or so feel almost entirely disconnected from the rest of the picture. After the murders are solved and we figure out why the Riddler has done what he's done, we just become aware of a new, second, much larger plot involving previously undiscussed seawalls in the city.
The seawall was very briefly mentioned in the first act.
Oh, was it very brief? Okay,
it's it's like in a news report. I think one of those instances where they're watching TV news.
Whatever. The point is not exactly a big thing. And there's a very underbaked social media angle to this. The Riddler, you know, releases things to the newscasts, but like there's a whole bit at the end about that's basically a parody of Twitch and Discord or something like that. Get to that in 1 second.
And the dark web. Yeah.
And the dark web. We'll get to that in 1 second. The other thing that's going on here is that there is, again, a completely underbaked political angle about a transformational, you know, political figure who we're supposed to be cheering for and want to succeed. And I couldn't tell you a single thing she's for. I had no idea what she's doing here, but she, you know, she's young and she's charismatic, African-American. She's going to make the change.
She's against corruption.
For a movie that is as long as it is, what I'm saying here is that it still feels as though it's missing scenes. It just feels like it is missing scenes kind of connecting the various plot points. For instance, again, in this film, the Riddler is shown gathering an army on like Discord or Twitch or some such video streaming site. And it's you know, it's an indictment of the rage-filled white man who feels left behind by the forces of blah, 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 whatever. Fine, okay, interesting enough. That could have very easily mirrored, say, the Batman and his efforts to inspire fear by going viral on social media. Earlier in the film, he calls himself Vengeance. I'm Vengeance. And then that is, like, mockingly picked up by Selina Kyle and the Penguin later in the movie. Why are they calling him that? Did they take video of him saying it and it went viral on YouTube? I don't understand why they know he calls himself Vengeance. Does he introduce himself? Does he say, "Hi, I'm Mr. Vengeance"?
Because everybody in the underworld talks to each other. There's not that many people, Sonny.
Doesn't make any sense. I'm sorry. Doesn't make any sense. Like, none of this really connects together. We just see some signs at one of the funerals with people holding up Riddler signs. And I'm sorry, this was done much, much better in 2019's The Joker. And at 2/3 the runtime. Alyssa, I kind of like this movie. I didn't hate it. It just feels weirdly sloppy to me. Am I nitpicking it too much?
No, I don't think so at all. There's a version of this. When Peter and I were walking out of the theater, he said something that I thought was really perceptive, which is that this feels like the first episode of the second season of The Batman. And I think that's absolutely right, because there's way too much going on in this movie and none of it gets the attention that it deserves in a way that makes the whole thing feel sort of oddly disconnected and incomplete. And the version of this that I like best is the one that is effectively David Simon's The Batman, right? Because it is, you know, it is specifically the sort of inciting conversation in the movie is about how Thomas Wayne set up this fund for the revitalization of Gotham that, you know, Bella Real, the Afro-Latina mayoral candidate, basically says hasn't worked, right? It's, you know, it has become this huge sink. And over the course of the movie, we come to find out that's because the figures who were part of a major sting to shut down a drug dealing operation have essentially taken power in Gotham and used that that urban renewal fund as sort of a personal piggy bank. They've basically looted it while not doing anything effective with the money. And that's a really interesting idea, right? The idea that, you know, the Wayne family's philanthropy has become sort of counterproductive, that the corruption in the city means that to a certain extent, the very existence of a fund like this was not just an invitation to corruption, but that has actively made the city worse. A significant part of the plot of the movie, and spoilers here, is effectively that the current mayor of Gotham has, like, pulled a Jimmy McNulty faking a bunch of murders. And as, you know, the sting that took down the drug lord was sort of orchestrated from within. It's not really the real blow against crime that it's been made out to be. But in this version of the movie, that's effective, right? Like, he gets away with it, at least for a while. And so, you know, the version of the Batman that is about, you know, very real challenges with urban renewal, it would be more grounded than most comic book movies normally get, and sort of newly relevant at a time when a lot of urban areas, including DC, are seeing increases in violent crime, inspired partly by the sort of antisocial effects of the pandemic. And you could do that in a way that is, you know, really interesting without having to be obvious in the way that, like, Selena Kyle, you know, complaining about, like, rich white men is sort of feels shoehorned in and sort of it's almost a fourth wall breaking moment. And it doesn't work from a dialogue or performance perspective at all. But so you could have had this nice sort of lightning strikes moment either with the sort of idea of urban decay or resurgent urban decay, or with the Riddler's, like, social media troll army leading up to January 6th. But, you know, that idea emerges in the last third of the movie with no setup at all.
Shows up almost entirely out of nowhere. I mean, literally the only hint that we have of any of this, there's like a 5-second shot of people holding Riddler signs at a funeral. That's
right.
It.
Yeah. And there's just no sense of how any of this is happening. And also, like, wouldn't the idea that there are Riddler signs at the funeral be interesting to Batman and be, like, something that he wants to investigate? Like, if he and Alfred are, like, good at the internet, shouldn't that be something that they, like, go ahead and figure out? And I think that, in a way, the biggest example of this is actually the Catwoman story. And, you know, I think Zoe Kravitz is good in this. I think Zoe Kravitz is good in general. I think she is fantastic in Kimmy, a movie we talked about, I think, on last week's bonus episode. But the sidelining of a bunch of the movie into Catwoman's backstory is, you know, it doesn't serve either of those kind of bigger ideas. And it's just, like, it's a total swerve. And, you know, it feels really unfortunate, right? I mean, Anne Hathaway, you know, just, as her version of Catwoman doesn't get the sort of backstory or the explanation, but she fits into the movie that she's a part of sort of much more seamlessly and effectively than Zoe Kravitz's Catwoman does here. And I do think it'll be interesting to see if her departure for Bloodhaven, you know, portends a Catwoman spinoff that could be interesting. But I don't think she fits into the movie at all. And in part because Kravitz is so charismatic in the role, it's almost the part of the movie that I wish had been excised so it could kind of stand on its own and have more room to breathe.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I remember people complaining about The Dark Knight, Christopher Nolan's 2008 film, being too long, and it has this extra ending that shouldn't have been there. But everything that happens, I rewatched it this week because I've been trying to figure out what exactly went wrong with The Batman. Everything that happens in that last 40 minutes of The Dark Knight is presaged or foreshadowed by everything else that happens in the movie. It's all actually very tightly connected together. And this just feels off from a structural point of view. Right, Peter?
Yeah, I totally agree that this movie is really flawed structurally. And I had very mixed feelings about this film. In some ways, it should be targeted towards me just about perfectly. I really loved Matt Reeves' Apes films. I'm a huge fan of the obvious inspirations here. David Fincher is my favorite living director. Seven and Zodiac are two of my favorite films. I've seen both of them a dozen times or more. Matt Reeves has also talked about how Taxi Driver was an influence here, although I think somewhat less so, but just in terms of the urban grittiness and sort of the distraught, the central character who is in some ways he's a vigilante whose vigilante quest is we're both supposed to understand it, and there's a way in which it's misguided. And this, I think, is where the movie has some real trouble that I actually want to ask the two of you about, because Sonny, you picked up on some of this. Alyssa, you talked about it a little bit. I think this movie is uncomfortable with the idea of Batman, but I think specifically it is uncomfortable with the political implications of Batman. And this movie seems to gesture at. I don't mean that it's like an anti-Batman screed. This is not like an op-ed in The Nation or anything like that. It doesn't go nearly that far. But this seems to be a movie that gestures towards a left-wing, billionaire skeptical vision of Batman that is just deeply uncomfortable with the inherently reactionary and right-wing nature of a billionaire white guy who tries to save the city by like dressing up in some weird cosplay comes from inherited wealth. And in fact is part of, or has links to, because of his family, has these links to the city's corruption. At the beginning of the movie, he talks about like the voiceover that bookends the film is about like how he's trying to learn to save the city. And in the end, he's like, well, you know, maybe the methods that I was originally thinking about, maybe I need to rethink what I'm doing and find other ways to help. And I think Catwoman's place in this movie is that we are supposed to understand that this is in some sense a film about how we're the Batman, the movie called The Batman is in some ways not supposed to be about Batman. It's supposed to be about how we're supposed to look elsewhere to save our cities, not towards these billionaire white guy heroes, but towards the young black reformer mayoral candidates and towards, Catwoman, who's always been standing at the wings waiting to sort of take center stage. And I don't think the movie develops these ideas very well. And maybe I'm crazy to see them in there because I feel like other critics have not seen this as a particularly left-wing film. This movie seems like a film that is politically uncomfortable with Batman. And maybe this is, I think, maybe a little more of a stretch, but uncomfortable with the fact that Christopher Nolan made three increasingly right-wing and reactionary Batman films. And this movie seems to want to not respond, but twist that idea back on itself. And part of it, like the most interesting thing to me is this movie has the thing that we've seen in Batman films so many times, which is the hero and the villain. You know, the villain thinks, oh, I'm just like you, right? And we're flip sides of each other. That was obviously, in the Dark Knight with Joker, sort of saying, oh, look, we complete each other, whatever. And the Nolan version of this film responds to that by saying, yes, there are ways in which you are similar, but ultimately Batman is the good one. And Batman's inherent goodness and is what makes him the hero here. And the Batman, the Reeves film, looks at the connection between Batman and Dano's Riddler and says, yeah, maybe actually they are kind of the same. And the Batman is in some sense a villain.
Alyssa, what do you make of that? You're the bleeding heart liberal on the show.
Well, I mean, I thought what was sort of funny about the final act of this movie is that, like, it's not so much that Batman pivots to, giving away 50% of his wealth. He pivots to being Superman, right? I mean, you see him doing humanitarian rescue stuff and protecting people and, like, you know, sort of he comes out into the day as, like, the sun is rising over Gotham and he's, like, loading people into boats and stuff. And it's, I don't think it's a condemnation of kind of superheroes writ large, but within the sort of superhero oeuvre, it's a response, I think, not just to Christopher Nolan, but to a certain extent to Zack Snyder's Superman, right? It's like, it's not just that, it's not good for Batman to be a fascist. It's that it's good for superheroes to be more like the idealized version of Superman who primarily, yes, he fights bad people, but like he saves people, right? He swoops in and like makes sure that they're okay. And that last sort of the movie is, you know, about both about Batman rescuing other people and about being rescued, right? I mean, he, you know, there is an action beat where Selina Kyle shows up to, you know, save his armored ass. And also where, you know, after he has been grievously injured, gives himself this shot of adrenaline. Is
or,
beating the-
or possibly venom. Bane's venom. We don't know.
Look like venom to me.
Whatever. And is beating the hell out of one of these Riddler followers and then stops, right? It's like the idea is like, actually, you don't want to be this toxic, violent, you know, version of superheroism. You want to be a protector. You want to be a rescuer. And so it's hard for me to see it within the sort of larger context of politics as they exist outside the superhero universe, because all of those feints are so poorly developed and sort of left hanging. But within the sort of political conversation that exists within superhero movies, I do think it feels like a response both to Nolan's Batman and to Snyder's Superman.
I definitely want to see the David Simon version of this. I really think that, seriously, like when you said that to me, Alyssa, I was like, oh yeah, that's in some ways what this movie is trying to get at. It's a sort of critical look at Gotham as a series of political institutions of which Batman is part of, right? And it sort of partakes in this idea that's always inherent in the Batman movies and stories in particular, that Gotham is a sort of a city state unto itself, right? And so, you know, even like The Dark Knight Rises, the third film in the Nolan trilogy, makes this pretty explicit. Yes, there is a sort of federal response outside, but like Bane is cutting off the city and making it because in the Batman world, he's never out to save the country or the world. He's only out to save Gotham because Gotham is his whole world. And its politics always define his whole political universe. And here you see these sort of the same, like this, a movie that tries to deal with that, but I think doesn't actually give us enough real politics to do anything with.
Well, what I said to you guys after I saw it was it's like film Twitter wrote a Batman movie. Because what this movie has done
is
it is
the most damning thing that Sonny Bunch could say about a Batman movie.
Because it has internalized all of the critiques of Batman that like go viral on Twitter every few months or so. Like, wouldn't Batman be better off giving money to social services than beating up mentally ill people? And this movie says, yes, that would in fact be better.
Well, except that it doesn't, because, you know, giving $1 billion to urban renewal has only resulted in more corruption.
No, only because it hasn't been given to somebody who knows what to do with it, like Bella Rial. That's the whole purpose of her characters. It needs a good, honest person to, you know. What else does this? I mean, this
there's
movie
a weird,
essentially.
Like, there's this weird, again, it's just a gesture. It's just a feint. It doesn't actually develop it. But there's like a weird gesture that like this is a movie about global warming, among other things, right? Like the seawall stuff. And it's just sort of there without any context. It's like, at the very end, you know, global warming. That's a problem, too. Is Batman really going to save us from that? I don't think so. Going to need politics.
It is interesting because the combination I don't know if you guys read there was a great New York Times feature about the extent to which Chicago is, which is the real world analog for Gotham, is in genuine danger of being drowned, right? Like, that is a city that is not going to survive global warming in its present form. And there is really interesting storytelling to be done about flooded cities, right? Like reminiscence sort of gestures at this with its version of Miami as Venice. Kim Stanley Robinson's really great novel, New York 2041, which like really should be optioned as a limited series, is about a sort of New York as Venice. So there's interesting stuff to be done with the idea of flooding cities. But
Kim Stanley Robinson is left-wing, and I have real issues with his politics, but he's a great writer. And the thing is that he's not afraid of actually just engaging very directly with the implications and specifics and substance of his political ideas. I mean, his most recent novel opens with like a long explanation of a UN charter that creates a sort of quasi-governmental, supra-governmental agency that then becomes the thing that the rest of the book is about. And like, he's just like, yep, that's what it's going to be like, guys. It's going to be a lot of bureaucracy. And he like then actually develops that. And this movie sort of wants us to see Batman as fitting uncomfortably in a world of politics, but it doesn't actually want to engage in politics because it's a $200 million superhero movie.
Well, it wants to gesture at politics. This is why you have Selina Kyle saying, oh, who cares about these white privileged people. Yeah. It is like film Twitter internalized all of the arguments against Batman and then like regurgitated a computer based AI script for the film. That is what this is like.
Because I've said a lot of sort of negative things about this movie, I wanted to say one thing I did generally like, which was really for me encapsulated in the car chase scene with the Penguin, is I thought that this was largely an effective de-escalation of the superhero movie, right? I mean, there's not a portal to another dimension opening up. There is not a, you know, world-killing threat. Even the sort of breaching of the seawall is not intended to destroy the city, but to sort of drive a lot of refugees to a place where there can be a gun-based massacre. And what I liked a lot about that car chase sequence is that it takes things that are sort of fundamentally frightening to think about, like being on a busy highway with a lot of trucks in the dark and the rain, the idea of someone driving in the wrong direction at a high speed on the highway, and just turns that into an action sequence that is, I actually found, sort of more effectively nerve-wracking than anything I've seen in a Marvel movie in years. And that's partially because, you know, I'm not the world's most confident driver. I don't like driving in those specific circumstances. But I thought it represented a really effective kind of step down, saying, like, you know, we just don't need, like, we don't need to destroy New York every movie. We can still be tense and interesting. And I don't think it's a perfect action scene, but I thought the conception of it was really nice and represented just some more developed thought than I think we see elsewhere in the script.
All right. So what do we think? Thumbs up or thumbs down on The Batman? Peter.
I literally can't answer that question. I find this movie both very frustrating, and there's a lot that I admire about it just on a craft level. I think the best answer I can give you is, in some ways, this is what you said in your review, Sonny, is I had very mixed feelings, but I'll probably see it again.
How dare you? Alyssa.
Yeah, I'm going to
answer the question. Thumbs up or thumbs down?
I'm going to say a mild thumbs up because I also want to see it again, in part to clarify what I think about it.
I give it a mild thumbs down just because my review was mixed negative, and a lot of people on Twitter were very upset about that because how dare I say anything bad about The Batman? But it is this movie is a structural mess, and if you compare it to, like, again, even a movie like The Joker, Joker. It's just, we've got Joker and The Batman. Does many of the same things, and it does it better, frankly.
And so under 2 hours, 20 minutes.
Under 2 hours. Yeah,
I think
right,
it's
about
155, if I recall correctly.
So it's too long. It's a mess. This movie's a mess. Needed some work in apparently there's a 4-hour cut somewhere. Release the Reeves cut. That's what I want to see. Release the Reeves cut.
David Simon's The Batman. I'm just saying, like, HBO has been, give David Simon $200 million to make.
I mean, again, it's just because it's a real problem that these superhero franchise starters are being treated effectively as mini series that you have to go sit in the theater rather than just like, here's an individual story. And if you want to set up like a sequel, give us a post credits tag. But like, just tell me a story in 2 hours and 20 minutes, even. That's a long movie. And it's really telling that they couldn't, like, there's 6 movies in this movie, and I don't think any of them.
All right, Squish. All right, that's enough out of you. You wouldn't even give me a thumbs up or a thumbs down. Quiet, you. That is it for this week's show. If you loved it, make sure to check out our members-only bonus episode coming Friday to atma.thebulwark.com on Zelensky and the former actor's efforts to save his nation and go down as one of the great world leaders in modern history. I think that's fair to say. And make sure to tell your friends. A strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If you don't grow, we will die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SunnyBunch. I'll convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys next week.